You know, in America over the past year, we've been really fascinated watching the upheaval we've been calling the Arab Spring. Maybe a little less thrilled now that it's in the immediate past. But this story must seem kind of familiar to you, doesn't it, given all you've seen in Chile in the course of your lifetime?
Yes, of course. It's quite familiar. I never thought, by the way, because Chile has a long-standing democratic tradition, so I never thought that it was going to be a 17-year dictatorship in Chile. But the fact of how are you trying to gather different forces disseminated in society at the time when you didn't have the web, you didn't have internet, you didn't have a Twitter or Facebook or whatever, so it was much more difficult to get in touch to each other. Yeah. And any kind of movement like this one is and has to be a grassroots movement that you start from the soul of the society upwards. Yeah. And therefore, it's not easy. Finally, when you reach the square, like in Cairo, well, that's, I wouldn't say it's the end story, but because it's the beginning of some other story. But needless to say, it's a very incredible point to reach where they were. At the same time that in our case, well, it was a process by which civic organization, political parties, trade unions, gender movements, artists, everywhere. And everybody sensed that they can do something in order to get rid of a dictatorship.
Yeah. Well, this must also seem to you as though it's a perfectly logical outcome. You've lived through a number of different revolutions, and you've been politically aware. I was thinking about it because when you were a boy, there was a revolution almost of the same kind we're seeing now, but with very different results. Egypt under Nasser, and of course, India under Gandhi.
Yes, of course. I mean, needless to say, those movements capture my imagination. I still remember 1956 when there was a Suez invasion of the British and the French, and then to be humiliated by the defeat, you know, the big powers. And here you have a colonel, first Naguib and then Nasser, and then you have what happened in India with Nehru, and then you have that was the cause of those faraway countries, you know, that captured the imagination of somebody, but they were fighting for the independence of their own countries, in a sense, you know, even though you have a king, Farouk, in Egypt, well, it was a fight for your real independence.
Well, I think people in this country may have forgotten some of what happened in those places. The Suez invasion isn't something that that comes up very often. People don't remember as much the British colonization of India. And by the same token, we tend to forget that with which you began, that there is a long history, democratic history in Chile. We tend to think of Chile as the place where General Pinochet had a long, long period of dictatorship.
Yeah, but before that, you know, it's interesting because since 1831, after a very brief period of anarchy in Chile, we used to have a president elected by 5 years, re-elected once, so that means that with four names, you have 40 years of Chilean history. Every president ruled the country during 10 years with an independent Congress, an independent judiciary, all those things that for us seem so normal, you know. Yeah. And even though we have a period of a civil war because a parliament regime, well, no more than 120 days since 1831 to 1973, there was no rule of law in Chile. No more than 120 days. And then 17 years of dictatorship is rather awkward by Chilean standards.
Yeah. It's extraordinary, and yet what is most familiar to us, although not in detail, I think, is the Chile that we see in the very first pages of your book. You start with a description of a really truly remarkable television interview you engaged in on April 25th, 1988. Will you describe that for us a little? Why was it so important?
It was very important because at that time we were 6 months before a plebiscite, and everybody thought that the plebiscite under the dictator is something to be very easy to win because you are precisely a dictator. And we thought that was possible then, because of those democratic traditions, to mobilize the people, to make them register to vote, because at that moment, it was up to a citizen to register or no, according to peculiar Pinochet legislation. And needless to say, all of those in favor of Pinochet were planning to register, of course. And the question was, how are we going to be able to make register the majority of the Chilean people to defeat those partisans of Pinochet? We had the idea that Pinochet probably has a 40% of the total vote, and the electoral could be about 8 million people. So we say, well, 40% of 8 million is 3.2 million people are going to be for Pinochet. So if we are able to register 7 million Chileans, we succeed. that was the elementary arithmetic of the whole thing.
Right.
But nobody wanted to register.
Well, they were all afraid. It's important to remember what Pinochet had done.
I mean, thousands of people in jail, something of people disappear, something of people has been executed. Thousands and tens of thousands has been living and were living in exile. I think that was not a single family that couldn't have some impact, terrible impact on Pinochet's, on their own life.
So
my own family was, all of them was abroad by several reasons, you know. So that kind of things is very difficult to understand. And therefore, when that people registered, then we went again and said, look, but now we need that a few of you dare to defy the dictator and allow us to register as a political party. Yes, as a legal political party. It's rather unusual, a legal political party in a dictatorship. And that means that those people are going to register in favor of a party that was going to call no, and it was calling no to Pinochet. And at that time, I tried to convince them and tell them, look, if we are a legal party, we are going to be on TV. And when I was invited, I had no idea that we were going to be invited to a particular program. But when they received that invitation, well, we decided to do a very professional work, because not because of ourselves, but because of those that dare to defy Pinochet. And this is the reason why we prepare, and this is the reason why we address straight to Pinochet, and this is the reason why I didn't accept when I was going to be interrupted, and this is why I say, excuse me, I'm talking tonight for 15 years of silence, and this is why I would like to address Pinochet.
What's so extraordinary about this, and what I think is difficult for an outsider perhaps to understand, but once you realize it, it's so dynamic, it's hard to believe. You knew Pinochet was probably watching, and you spoke directly into the camera and therefore pointed your finger at him and said, as you just did, I speak for 15 years of silence.
Yeah.
Weren't you scared of what would happen next?
Well, I didn't know, you know, because I had a second intervention about how Pinochet rigged the plebiscite in 1980, but this one was not going to be rigged by Pinochet because we are going to have our own appointed people because we were a legal party to count the votes. And the program came to an end, and I was very mad because I couldn't say what I wanted to say. And one of the journalists say, Mr. Lagos, you have no idea what happened tonight. You don't realize that you have produced a tremendous change in this country for what you say. And I say, no, because I wanted more things to say, you know. It was a funny story. If I can tell you a small anecdote, about 20 years later, I had grandchildren, and once in around a barbecue on a Sunday came the discussion about Lagos Finger. And some of them say, "It is true that you address straight to Pinochet?" I say, "Yes." And then they say, "We would like to see." "Well," I say, "but this is in Facebook and in Google. You just put Ricardo Lagos and the finger and you are ready." So they went to see that. They listened to the 5 minutes part of that program. And when that finished, they saw me and say, "And that was all?" Because, of course, in today's world, you know, that is nothing. To be finger pointing to somebody is what any politician normally do in a presidential debate with your opponent, you know.
But at that time, those 5 minutes were extraordinary, beyond what anyone had been able to do up to that point.
Yeah, well, you know, when I left the studio, there it was about 11 o'clock at night, and was about 100 or 200 people around clapping and saying bravo, bravo, etc. And I thought that that was normal whenever you used to go to a TV studio. Needless to say that never in the many times that I have been returning to that and to some other TV studios, when I finished my program, never has been waiting for me outside.
Well, and the result of this was that you did win. Not you in particular, but your...
Yeah, but the Chilean people. I mean, they lost to Be Afraid, and I think that the first... everybody will tell you that the first reaction of Pinochet was to take the tanks to the streets. A general with some common sense says, "Of course, my general, I will tell the tanks immediately to the street, but to go where?" Yeah.
Yeah, well, it must have been an extraordinary time for him, too. I want to talk a little bit about how you got there. I mean, you came of age at a really amazing time, didn't you, in the 1950s. Well, the possibilities must have seemed endless at that point, but then you came to the U.S. for the first time right as civil rights were beginning to come to the forefront here, didn't you? Must have been a sense of the problems here, perhaps reflecting the problems at home for you?
Yes, but what really surprised me was that in Chile we were very much political active in the reason that we were talking before, the questions of Nasser and in the world and the changes in the new independent countries, etc. And I discovered that in United States, graduate students primarily worry about getting a good grade and have a good job. And during those days, it was rather easy for a graduate with a PhD in economics to get a good job. So I was rather surprised for that. But on the other hand, the questions of racial discrimination, well, you know, in Chile we have no Afro-American people. They say that it's a country too cold so that those coming from Africa wouldn't resist. But the fact is that we have not that kind of discrimination. We may have some other kind of discrimination, but not that one. So for me, it was incredible, you know, when the old lady that rented in a small apartment told me, "And tomorrow, don't forget, when you take the bus, you sit in the first 10 front seats of the bus, you know, because in the back seat of the bus is for the Negroes, for the colored people." Yeah.
I think that what's most interesting about that may be that is what you described, that in Chile, when you were studying, the discussion was all radical politics, all about the world, about injustices. And here, not so much. Although, because of what you had studied, looking at American economic theory must have been very interesting for you, because this was the time when the Keynesian policies of the New Deal of FDR were beginning to fade and be replaced by, what do you call them, the Chicago Boys?
The Chicago Boys, yes.
Milton Friedman.
I remember once, you know, even Milton Friedman went to Duke. And, well, I found that the policies were rather unusual, you know. Still, almost everybody in my faculty was a good Keynesians, and we used to be taught about Keynesian economics, yes.
Well, did you know already then, listening to these discussions of different economic theory, how important this was going to be in the future of Latin America?
Yeah, I mean, I got the impression, of course, that we were a very underdeveloped continent at that time, and therefore there's many things to do. And that is the reason why I moved from a lawyer that I was in Chile and rather unusually came to this country to study economics, because I thought that was much more important. And for me at that time, the idea was just to be a member of the academia, to teach and something like that. Now, of course, interested in public affairs, but my primarily question was to teach, and I returned, in fact, to Chile to teach.
Just to clarify it, Keynesian economics is basically more interested in government, and the Chicago boys of Morton Friedman are more into free market policies. And that conflict played out over the next decade or two in Latin America, didn't it? Especially in Chile, and especially in the governments of Salvador Allende and then the dictatorship of Pinochet.
Of course, of course. And the fact was that I found the policies of the neoliberals from Chicago impossible to be implemented in Chile. And when they did only because of force. And I think that many of the things that they predicted was wrong, you know, to apply those things when you have a country with 170,000 textile workers and you just open the country and those 170,000 workers are reduced to only 30,000 textile workers in Chile, then you have an idea of what happened.
Throughout this, you were not central to the politics of Chile, but you were always on the edges. You were a friend of the young Salvador Allende, weren't you?
Yes, I mean, I was. I wouldn't say a friend because we have 30 years of difference. But I published some written texts, and some of them got the imagination and got to be known by Allende, and he called me in some occasions. And in fact, I was able to participate in the 1964 and 1970 campaigns of Allende for being president. Yes.
Oh, how hopeful you must have been.
Well, everybody in Chile was very much hopeful of what was going on, needless to say, yes.
So where were you when the coup took place?
Well, at that time, you know, I was ambassador designate to go to Moscow for Allende. And at that time, ambassador has to be approved by the Chilean Congress. And in the Chilean Congress, in the Senate, Allende has no majority. So the nomination of the ambassador in Cuba, in United States, in Paris, in Moscow, were pending, you know. So that's the reason why I didn't go to Moscow. Till many, many, many years later when I arrived there as a president in an official visit. Yeah. And then, you know, at that time I was still in the academia and I was a secretary general of a faculty of social sciences, the Latin American Faculty of Social Sciences. This is what I was doing. So I was very close, and for some other reasons I knew the same day that Allende has died in La Moneda, and he committed suicide, yeah.
Did you leave Chile immediately? Did you know that it was not going to be safe for you to be there when Pinochet and his people
took
over?
Well, as I say in the book, a cousin of mine, rather distant cousin, but a cousin of mine that was working for the Navy, he told me that wanted to talk with me, and I went to see him and said, look, Ricardo, I have received so many curriculum vitae about you that it's a question of days that finally they will get you. I was not on a high, you know, but they were trying to get some other more important people than me. So it was very clear, and I moved then to Buenos Aires, among other things, because that Latin American faculty will have to move from Chile to some other place, and Buenos Aires was one of the places where we stay. And while there, I got a kind invitation to return to the United States as a visiting professor in Chapel Hill. And I spent then from the middle of 74 to the middle of 75 as a visiting professor in North Carolina.
How hard it must have been to be outside the country while all of this was going on. You must have wanted to be there.
Yeah, of course, of course. I formally was not in an exile because I have not been expelled from Chile, but it's like living in exile and, you know, you never know when you will be able to return. Yeah. And then here in this country, they was very kind. I got an offer to become involved in some other American university. At the same time, I got an offer to work for UNESCO in a program to promote social sciences in Latin America, to be living in Buenos Aires. So I returned to Buenos Aires, and I spent the next 3.5 years in Buenos Aires. Mm. And again, that was not a very difficult. That was a very difficult time because a good attack came in Buenos Aires, and I repeat the whole cinema, the whole movie again, you know, with a new coup d'etat. And then
you went back eventually. You finally made your way back to Chile.
In 78.
But before Pinochet was gone.
No. I mean, I arrived in the when Pinochet was in as powerful as ever. And you can see almost no window out of the room where we were in the Chile of those days. So it was a very lengthy movement. I was used to work in my official capacities during the day, and in the evenings and nights, we tried to talk to each other, trying to think. And the first thing I would say, it's interesting, was to discuss ideas. What should be the Chile after Pinochet? We were so far away from that was only a theoretical discussion. I mean, how the world is changing, what's going on, and what we did wrong that finally we have a coup d'etat in Chile and the breakdown of our democratic system. So we start thinking, and then because of the Chicago Boys, they fail in the sense that the crisis hit Chile very much. Our gross domestic product was reduced by 20% from one year to the next in 81, 82, 83. And then the country was most matured 10 years after Pinochet in power to protest for the first time. And the first protest came out in May 83. And then I had to resign from the United Nations. And there was a small political opening. And the members of my party, most of them in exile or being executed, asked me to represent them in a coalition that called Alliance, Democratic Alliance, that was the first coalition of different democratic parties to be opposed to Pinochet.
You have lived through so much in your lifetime in Chile, and you have also lived outside, so you've looked at all of this. I wonder, how much do you think what has happened in Chile represents what's happening in Latin America as a whole? Is what Chile has managed to do an example for other countries in Latin America?
I wouldn't say an example, but let me tell you, at the time of Chile dictatorship, there was a moment where, with the exception of two or three countries, all the rest were dictatorships. So the so-called authoritarian regimes, as the members of the academia used to call during those days, you know, those bureaucratic authoritarian regimes were the common institutions in the region. You have it in Chile, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Uruguay, in Peru, in Bolivia, in Ecuador, everywhere, you know. And therefore, the question was that the first one to return to democracy was because of the Falkland Islands or the Malvinas Island. The fault of the military from Argentina trying to take Falkland Island from England, and Margaret Thatcher, with the blessing of the United States, decided to defend the islands. And the military were defeated, and because they were defeated, they had to leave power, and they opening then for return to democratic country with Alfonsín in Argentina. 2 years later, that was in Uruguay. 3 years later, something similar in Brazil, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
And the other thing that's fascinating to me about this is how everything seems to keep coming around. You were involved in Chile before Pinochet and after Pinochet, and he kept coming back to you. You eventually describe what must have been a difficult scene, but it's funny in a way. You were forced to shake hands with this man,
yes,
whom you were at least partly responsible for ousting.
Yes. Well, it was a very unusual transition. If you allow me to say this, President Bush, the senior, paid an official visit to Chile with President Elwin as a president, as a way to say, well, we recognize that now this is a democratic country. And there was a rather large official banquet in the presidential palace for President Bush. And at that moment, President Bush says, and what happened with Pinochet? And Elwin say, well, you know, Mr. President, Pinochet is seated in that table because he's still the commander-in-chief of the army. How I say, oh, by the way, Mr. President, about a quarter minutes later, what happened with Allende's widow? Is he still living? Oh, yes, Mr. President. Allende's widow is in that table because we decided that we should be here in this banquet in honor of you. Would you like to say hello to the widow of President Allende? I'm sure that President Bush couldn't believe that in the same palace that Pinochet ordered to throw away with bombs against Pinochet, against Allende, in the same palace was in that table Pinochet and in the other Allende's widow. Well, that's the kind of transition that we had. Yeah. It's not to be very proud of, but it was necessary to have a long transition. As I used to say my Spanish friends, well, you know, you had to wait for Franco to be dead to start the transition to democracy. We did our transition with Franco alive as commander-in-chief of the army.
Quite a difference. Yeah. I noticed, by the way, in the paper the other day that the Spanish judge who was the one who ordered the arrest of Pinochet,
yeah,
has himself now fallen under investigation from presumably the forces who didn't like the kind of work that he was doing.
I think that your presumption is quite correct. I think that this is because many people in Spain, I wouldn't say that because Garzón decided to put in prison Pinochet. No, it's more than that, because he has been also making a few research in their own country with regard to what happened during the Civil War. Now, of course, the Civil War was in 1936, 1939, a long, long, long way ago. So it's much more difficult. But anyhow, I think that...
But you must have some sympathy for that, too, because there was a long period when you were in government after Pinochet, when you worked very hard to find out what happened to the disappeared.
Oh, yes, of course, to the disappear. We are the only country... Well, let me put it this way. The first Truth and Reconciliation Commission that served as an example to our friends in South Africa with President Mandela 4 years later was established in Chile in 1990. And then when I got the power, that was 10 years later, well, all those that has been political prisoners keep saying, look, when I go to ask for my papers, in my papers appear that has been in prison, and I have to explain that that was for political reason and I'm not a criminal. So they asked me to appoint a presidential commission to do a research on that, and we did. And 35,000 Chileans declared that they had been being tortured and had been subject of political prisoners, and of that 35,000, 29,000 were recognized by the commission. And once that the former President Clinton was in Chile, he paid a visit when I was president. We talked on this issue, and He said, why don't you put this in English? And the executive summary, we did it in English, and I sent to President Clinton because it's very unusual. But as I say to the country, in order not to deny again what we did, is the only way to have a future with regard to the future and not to repeat those crimes again.
President Lagos, you have been very generous with your time, but I wonder if I could ask you just one more question.
Yes, of course.
How much do you think is the story of Chile's democracy movement also the story of what's been happening across the rest of Latin America?
Well, I think that the rest of Latin America also know how to make transitions. Every country is a particular example, but also after that, how to run a country. All of us know what is a good economic policy. All of us know that because we have had in the past so many economic crises, we learned the lessons, and probably that is why we can say now, this is the first time when there is a huge economic crisis in the world, and we say, excuse us, but in this crisis, we are innocent. And probably because we have so many crises in the past, now we are better prepared with better regulations in our financial system, in some other economic areas, and this is why now we are emerged from this crisis better prepared in the Latin American continent.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jim, for this kind invitation. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.